There was this sudden attack on players by the gaming press. And that seemed extremely strange to me. I objected tremendously to the narrative that somehow the game developers were sitting around contemplating, how do we keep minorities out of the industry? How do we keep women from being here? And that's how they were presenting it. Like developers had this thing to keep people out. And it wasn't that case at all. I think in a funny way, by me quitting and leaving, it kind of took the wind out of the sails for the gaming press, because then they didn't have anybody else to attack. It was a good thing. And Hogwarts Legacy ended up coming out and being very successful anyway. All this sound and fury signified nothing in the end, right? They made all this noise and tried to boycott and tried to make the game look bad. And it's the best-selling game of the year. I saw there's an article out today that 6 months after Hogwarts Legacy has been launched, it is again hitting the top of the charts in the UK. It's made $1 billion. And this is in spite of a coordinated effort by the gaming press to shut it down. They were trying to tell people what they could like and what they couldn't like, what is right for them to play and what is not right for them to play. And gamers would have none of it. And I am so proud of gamers for doing that, you know, for saying, no, we're just going to play what we want to play. That's the right response.
Hello and welcome to Culturescape, the show that interviews the geek creators and influencers that built nerd culture. And today's episode is a spicy meatball. Just 2 years ago, one man, our guest, showed the world how ugly and partisan the gaming press had become, seemingly by doing nothing at all. Troy Levitt was a family man and experienced designer on Hogwarts Legacy for Avalanche when, to his shock, in February of that year, Kotaku released an article attacking him for a then long-dead YouTube channel. Soon, both barrels of the media were aimed squarely at Troy and his company, with claims of him being alt-right, a misogynist, anti-Semite, a grifter, and a TERF, none of which were remotely true, and they would have known that if they had bothered to ask. Yet they didn't. And they attacked him anyway, and so seemingly a month later, Troy announced his resignation and disappeared from the public spotlight. Fast forward to now, and Hogwarts Legacy is a big hit, and Troy is now comfortable to break down what was going on during that time, what he thinks of the gaming press, game development, and the outrage cycles that dominate the news. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Troy. I'm really excited to have you here today.
All right. Thanks, Peter. It's good to be here. And I guess it's going to be fun to rehash some of the old Hogwarts Legacy drama and stuff today. That little story there and how that all went down was kind of crazy. So it'll be fun to revisit.
It was, and I remember when that was happening in 2021, I was still with the post-millennial at that point, and it was just so crazy, because the attacks were so quick, and they seemed so well coordinated. Not that there was proof of that, but, you know, all of it felt a little too convenient, and it was like, you know, the only thing this guy here has done is, like, he had a YouTube channel at one point. It's like, okay, that's a cardinal sin, apparently.
My sense, I guess, for those who maybe, I'm guessing if they're watching this program, they kind of know a little bit about what went down. But yeah, it caught me completely by surprise, because I was just off working on Hogwarts Legacy and hadn't posted a video for 3 years, right? So my YouTube channel had been completely cold for 3 years. But I had posted a couple videos right after I had hired on to work on Hogwarts Legacy, before they had even announced that that's what they were working on. And so I know that WB had already reviewed all my videos. We had already had discussions about the videos, and they had said, you know, WB had reviewed them and said, okay, nothing that you've said here violates our policy, right? We've reviewed your videos. Nothing here violates. Some of what you say here might be considered kind of political or controversial. And, you know, you might want to think about how that could play out. They warned me about this at WB before any of it went down. But they didn't require me to remove videos. They didn't say, you know, you can't make any more videos or anything like that. And so I was like, I just left it alone, because I'm working on Hogwarts Legacy. It was 3 years later when suddenly the channel became the news story of the day. And it was really weird, even to me, like how fast that little news story exploded, right? It was like one or two articles. And then one of my friends out there who follows this sort of thing sent me a list, and there was about 100 articles published and translated all around the world in like 4 days, just like, whoa, just all
crazy.
Over. Yeah. And it was all the same kind of headline. Lead designer on Hogwarts Legacy used to run alt-right anti-feminist YouTube channel, right? They all kind of said that same thing. And I was very surprised because I never considered myself either alt-right nor anti-feminist, although I was critical of, you know, some third wave feminist ideas. So that's kind of the background on that. And it was pretty wild.
That's kind of the interesting thing about bringing you on the show, Troy, is I think you will, because you worked as a game developer and you've worked in games before it became, you know, like a mega popular place that, you know, it seems like everyone that covers games seems to want to join a company at some point. You've been on that side, but you've also now been on the side of where you're being attacked. So there are a few people who probably have that experience of a perspective on the issue of the gaming press and how they handle these stories.
Yeah, it was kind of strange because I think what I want to do, or maybe to frame this up, is that because I grew up loving video games and I got into the industry, you know, many, many years ago in the late 90s, just wanting to make games for players and kind of share that love of gaming, that a lot of my concerns with what happened in the gaming press back around 2014, this is the Gamergate time, you know, this is kind of what sparked my channel and some of the videos that I was making, was that there was this sudden attack on players by the gaming press. And that seemed extremely strange to me, you know, to have articles published at that point that said, gamers are dead. Gamers don't need to be your audience anymore. There's something wrong with the average, you know, gamer in America, and that there's this push to change by the gaming press and with Anita Sarkeesian to change how people were making games. And it felt to me like it was driving this wedge between players and developers and gaming press. And it was like it just had this whole notion of it's cracking open the industry in a way when I've always had this like nice, happy feeling of players and developers, we're on the same team. We want to make good games together. We want to share in our hobby together. And the press also, you know, serves an important role here too, because they're giving you good reviews and good information. And it just felt to me like the whole thing was being upended by this like, no, you guys are all making games wrong and you guys need to change how you're doing it. And it's really bad for women. It's really bad for minorities. And I was looking at the industry and saying, I don't think that's really the case at all. You know, I've been working in it now for 20 years at that point, and I thought that there was another side to the story, and I want to present that more positive side. So that's what I was doing when I was making those videos, was trying to counteract this gaming press narrative that I thought had caught hold, that there was something wrong with development and something wrong with the players, and I didn't think that was the case.
Yeah, well, it's something that's still there, and it definitely took hold. It's this default concept. You're just supposed to believe this is how it is. Like, this is the default. Everyone thinks they know how this works, that game developers are being attacked by the players and they're being overrun, and that, you know, they have to make sure that the very bad players, many of whom might be misogynists, et cetera, you know, they have to keep them in line. It is an antagonistic relationship where growing up, you know, even in college, it just wasn't that way. Maybe because gaming was smaller, but it did feel like, you know, like someone like Miyamoto, like he's the kind of guy you put on your wall. That's the kind of relationship. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, I hate those developers, I'm going to start sending death threats. No, that wasn't happening as far as I can tell for the most part.
Yeah, and I agree. It didn't feel like that to me growing up. You know, having worked at Disney and on Disney Infinity and all these kind of kids properties, you always had this very positive relationship, this attitude towards your players that it was awesome. That, you know, hey, we're doing this together. We're in this together. And so that was a lot of my objection, was I felt that the criticism was unfair and that it was misrepresenting the true state of the industry. But anyway, getting back then, so that was the context for the videos that I made. But then when they attacked me in the press, they positioned me as some sort of, you know, like a radical or something, that I was really resisting changes within the game industry to make it better. And I didn't feel like that was the case at all. I felt like I was more in the position of like, hey, games are great, we should invite everybody in, everybody get in here, but don't misrepresent what's going on in the industry to make it look like we're trying to keep people out. And that's what I objected tremendously to, the narrative that somehow the game developers were sitting around contemplating, you know, like, how do we keep minorities out of the industry? How do we keep women from being here? And that's how they were presenting it. Like developers had this thing to keep people out. And it wasn't that case at all. My entire time in the industry, from years going back, was always like, get everybody in here that you can. You know, we were always like, get all those different perspectives in. We wanted more female gamers. We wanted minority gamers. We wanted everybody in. It was never keep people out. It was always get people in. And so it was very strange to see the gaming press saying, no, 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 there's like this hierarchy of people trying to exclude and trying to keep, you know, people who aren't white male players out of video games. And that was the message that they were sending. And I thought it was very incorrect. So
it is very strange, because that's not, I mean, this is not dissimilar to like tabletop gaming. Like if a woman shows up, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, it's a miracle. You know, oh, this is like Christmas. You know, a member of the opposite sex has shown up to D&D night. To be honest, it was kind of like that often, which is a little bit embarrassing, but it wasn't this attitude of, you know, we have to keep these out. I think that's kind of the problem with the concept of gatekeeping, is it makes it sound like people are actively aware of it and they're actively doing it. If it is happening, I think it's pretty passive.
Yeah, I'm generally opposed to gatekeeping of the sort that's just trying to keep out people who are interested, right? I think that the gatekeeping of the sort where it's the preservation of something that people already enjoy and like, you know, that you're not tearing down, that can sometimes be a worthwhile gatekeeping. For example, I think it's worthwhile to gatekeep the Witcher series, right? You might want to look at the Witcher and you want to make sure that Geralt remains the center character because you're trying to be true to that property. But that to me would be like, you know, good gatekeeping from the standpoint of, say, the writers or the gamers who are working on that property. In the same way, like on Hogwarts Legacy, I think that there's a bit of gatekeeping that goes on, even at Avalanche, about protecting the lore, right? Making sure that the lore and that everything that has been put together by J.K. Rowling really fits and coheres, and that the new stuff that they bring in builds the entire like wizarding world without doing violence to it and trying to recreate it in our own image or something. It's respect for the property. And so, you know, I think that's the way to approach things as far as gatekeeping goes. If anybody, you know, wants to use that term gatekeeping, for me, it's, are you respecting the property? Are you trying to keep what people have found really wonderful about that property there? Then that's not really gatekeeping. That's just showing respect. But if you're trying to keep people out, if you're trying to keep people from enjoying that, then I think that's bad, because everybody should enjoy anything that they find fascinating or interesting or worthwhile.
I agree. I wish Netflix had that attitude. I think this, you know, we would be in a very much different situation with Witcher if they had, but alas, they did not. Let's back up this train. Let's put things in context, because your career is fascinating. You've kind of, the way your career has gone as a game developer has kind of gone with all the changes the industry has seen. So I think that's really interesting. That should give people some context, I think, into the kind of person you are. So how did you get into games in the first place? You were probably a young guy. I think I read somewhere that you served a LDS mission. So you're probably 21, 22, maybe, when you started looking into games.
Yeah, so I was a high school kid who loved video games, right? Back when it was on the old Apple IIs and stuff, and I taught myself programming and on the Atari 800 XL, and so I had this real interest in programming and games way back when they were still coin operated. I wanted to be a game developer, even in high school, when there was no role for it, right? Nobody knew what it was, really. It was just like people were making games, making money, which was kind of an issue with my parents. But yeah, I went on a Mormon mission from 1988 till 1990, Busan, Korea. So that's where I went there. And then I came back and I was at BYU. I ended up graduating from the University of Utah in 1995. So I switched schools in 1995.
No. You switched affiliations. You can't do that.
I totally did. I switched. In fact, I'm wearing a University of Utah shirt today, strangely enough. Now you're going to have to give me a hard time. Are you a BYU guy?
I am not. My siblings are, though. I don't care either way. I went to the state school.
Oh, well, that's cool. Anyway,
I'm, 95? I'm like Switzerland. I'm like, they can argue about around me. Yeah.
Yeah, between BYU and the U. 95 is really when I started working officially in the games industry for money. And that was for a small company in Orem, Utah, called Morpheus Interactive. And they made a game for the 3DO called VR Stalker. But anyway, that was how I got in. And I entered the industry about the same time as the transition from coin op into consoles was going. So it was the PS5 or the PS1, sorry, the very early PS1 was just hitting the market. And that's where I started, was at Morpheus. Then I went to what was then Sculptured Software, which became Acclaim, which worked on some wrestling games, Jeremy McGrath motocross game there, a few other games like that. And then I also worked at Single Track, which, you know, is the studio you interviewed with Dave Jaffe. So they did Twisted Metal and Jet Moto. I didn't work on Twisted Metal, but I did work on Jet Moto 2. And then Single Track was bought by a company called GT Interactive, and they split the studio into a studio called Lucky Devil. Lucky Devil is the one that then made Rogue Trip and then made the sequels to Twisted Metal when Sony picked them up. But Single Track, the studio I stayed with, failed. It went over and it became made some games called Critical Depth, which was like Twisted Metal underwater. I don't know if people remember that. It was like a submarine game.
It sounds interesting. I'm curious, but no, I've not heard of it.
It actually got reviewed pretty well. And then we made another game called Streak, which was like Jet Moto, but it was a hoverboard racing game, you know, before there were Tony Hawk games. So, you know, we made this game at Single Track, but neither of those games did very well in the market. And they ended up closing down Single Track, doing layoffs. And so I came back to Acclaim, and then I worked for Sapphire, then Sapphire shut down, and then Acclaim shut down. So we were bouncing around these studios. And I finally landed at Avalanche in 2003. And Avalanche is where I stayed from 2003 until 2021, which Avalanche is a studio that came out of that development environment there in the Salt Lake City, Utah area, where there were a lot of little studios that were forming up, including Single Track, which came from Evan Sutherland, which was a military sim place. So anyway, there's this real fruitful thing going on in Salt Lake City for game development that most people don't realize was happening back in the 90s and the early 2000s. Ed Catmull, who came out, who formed Pixar, came out of the University of Utah. So anyway, there's just kind of this like, this wonderful like Salt Lake City. It's almost like Austin, Texas, like this little hub of game development that happened right there in Salt Lake. And that's where almost all of my history then is at. It's in the Salt Lake City environment and the people who work there. So there's kind of that, I guess you were asking me about my history in games. There's a little bit of how I came to Avalanche anyway.
No, you're excited. You do have an interesting history. Acclaim is one of those companies. It's kind of, it's painful to look at because they made so many, they were like the top of the world. And then they made so many bad business decisions, just horrible, horrible ones. And hardly anyone remembers them unless they're like old, you know, like me, who remembers the Turok games. Or yes, people Turok, remember Mortal Kombat used to be owned by someone else. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, the studio in Salt Lake City, Sculptured Software, that did a lot of wrestling games. And you're right, the Acclaim did seem to have a knack for making bad business decisions because they had the WWE, which is the WWF back then, the license to do, you know, the biggest wrestling title, but then they gave it up and went with a smaller company called ECW, and they had that ECW wrestling, and that did very poorly for them at Acclaim. So there's kind of this, they seem to have they seem to make a lot of mistakes there at Acclaim about the value of properties, I guess, you know, about what they should have done. They went for the small thing rather than the big one in terms of wrestling when they were doing those wrestling games. But sorry, that's neither here nor there.
Game development, like any big like entertainment or art project, it is a gamble. I mean, it's a little bit like Wall Street in that sense. It's like you're going to do this project. You don't necessarily know how it's going to come out. Even if you do a great job, maybe the timing's off. Something doesn't click, or someone else does the exact same game, but they put theirs out a week before you. It's like, you know, I think I'm hard on it because I love like game dev history, that kind of stuff. Like the What Happened YouTube channel is fantastic. But to be fair to the people who work on these things, it's like it really is a difficult thing to try to get right. At least that's my understanding of it.
I think you're totally right. It's incredibly difficult in the sense that you don't know what you have until you experience it, right? And that makes it very different from almost any other creative endeavor. Like when we used to work with Pixar at Avalanche, and you know, Pixar made all the movies and the films, and they would help us or they would work with us on the games we were doing for them. And they always struggled with the ideas that the player can do anything, right? And so when we're making our game, and we're saying like in Cars 2, this is an example I'm thinking of. In Cars 2, we had issues where we were trying to figure out how we could have like a case where Lightning McQueen is in the game and Mater's in the game, and can Lightning McQueen shoot Mater with machine guns, right? Because we're trying to have this like this crazy like Mario Kart style Cars 2 game. And there's no way that Pixar would ever let us do something like that in their normal world, right? Because that would never happen. And so they'll say things like, well, we'll just don't let the player do that. And you say, well, we can't. We don't know what the player is going to do in making a game. You have to kind of account for anything that the player may want to do if you give them the tools to do it. And it was very hard for somebody who worked in film to understand that in games, because the player is center, they can do anything. They can have any conversation that you prepared for them to do. They can go any place. They can interact with any character. So you don't have that tightly controlled sort of environment. That makes it super hard to make something, right? Because you're always in that position of what's the player going to do? Where's the player going to go? What are they interested in? It's kind of like you're trying to, and I've heard this analogy a few times, it's kind of like you're trying to fly an airplane at the same time you're building the airplane. You know, you're trying to get somewhere and make it happen, but you don't know how it's going to fit together and how it's all going to work. It's a brand new experience every time you get into making a game, because nobody's done quite what you're doing before, unless it's a sequel to what it's already been done, right? But yeah, they're very
difficult. It's an industry where you can't totally ever win. It's like, well, either you didn't change enough or you changed too much. It is a difficult industry, but I think part of that difficulty, though, like some of the stuff that has come out of the games industry, if we're talking about like artistic value, like that makes me feel like enlightened, like I actually experienced something that was really positive. I get more of that out, I think, of video games on a regular basis than I do necessarily movies, TV, even books to some degree, because I think that trial by fire does make a big difference.
Yeah, I agree with you too. It's very difficult, but it's also very rewarding. When you interviewed Dave Jaffe, he said something that I thought is totally true. That, you know, in order for games to be really good, you have to plan for them to be iterated on. Meaning that you have to, you know, have to build it, and then you have to experience it, and then you discover what's wrong, right? And you don't know what's wrong until you experience it. That's what's so hard about making a game, is you can't really know what you have until it's already built a little bit, you know, until it's at a point where you can experience it, and then you adjust, and then you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again. And that that process of constantly refining and remaking your game, because that's really what you're doing. You start making the game in one place and you remake it like 100 times over the course of development to where it finally ends up, is the real process of creative development, I think, is that iterative, come back and experience it, do it again, come back and experience it, do it again, and just always roll that ball up the hill. It's not at all like I sit down and make a plan and it just goes to plan. That never happens.
I was gonna say, I'm sure the suits love to hear that. That's their favorite.
They hate it. Yeah, they hate it. It's so hard to work in the game industry when you're dealing with, like imagine you're a movie guy, because people understand movies, and they come in, you've got executives, and they give you $100 million, and they want to see the script. They want to know what it is they're getting for $100 million. And normally in movies, you can kind of do that. You can sell them with something. But in a video game, it's really hard to sell them on what it is they're getting for their $100 million or whatever the price is, because all you can do is describe to them the things you're going to try, the things that you think are going to work, the direction you would like to go in. But you don't have any like clear plan until you start to experience it, and until you start to build it, and until you start to actually make it. And it could change. And that's why I think... that's why I think executives have a very difficult time working in the games industry if they don't already have experience there, because they can't see the vision of products that are still in development. You know, they can't see them all broken up like that. They want to see the nice, pretty finished product so they know their money's being well spent, and usually don't see that until really, really late in development.
There's a great anecdote by Rob Long. He was a writer on Seinfeld. He does Hollywood writing projects usually. Not so much producer, but he has this great story. One time he was brought for a boardroom meeting, and it's this Japanese company. They bought this big studio in Hollywood. This is one of their first big meetings, and he's in there, and they're trying to explain how the numbers work. Here's how we make money. And the guy was a top, well, why don't you just, and he says, look, we do all these pictures, you know, we'll put 20 out a year, you know, 10 will flop, 5 will do okay, and maybe we'll have one or two hits, and that's how we make the money. And the guy who probably didn't know what he was getting into, he says, well, why don't we make hits all the time?
Right, yeah. Just why don't you make everything a hit?
Yeah.
Why is it? Yeah, that is funny, but that is how they are, you know, inclined to think. And I kind of, you know, I don't really blame the executives for being very concerned about how the money is being spent. But it does make game development, especially at the AAA level, really, really difficult because there's so many eyes watching what's going on and so many feelings about, you know, what is the right thing to do to make it correct, to serve the different markets and all the rest of it. It becomes difficult to keep the vision coherent when you've got so many different, you know, thumbs in the pie. And I remember Jappy was saying this too, that, and I agree with him again, that I think a lot of your really interesting stuff happens first in the independent scene, that people go and try their cool ideas out there in the independent games. And then the AAA games will come and raid those indie games for their good ideas and bring them over into the AAA games after they've already been proven out on other, you know, versions.
Yeah, there's so many indie games. I'll get these, as small as I am, I'll get the press emails and we're like, these are the former developers. You know, I got one for a new game by former StarCraft II developers. And yeah, I can totally see that because it's like, okay, well, the company won't let us make this great game. We're going to go out there and do it ourselves and kind of like prove this works. And then, you know, we'll have a little studio and then someone will buy it up and the cycle repeats itself.
Yeah. And you're at a state now in the games industry where you can do it as an independent developer. It's been shown that, hey, if you've got the vision, the talent, and the drive, there's a pretty good chance you can make it.
No, that's fantastic. Yeah. I love it. Even like in, I wouldn't call them independent necessarily, but Larian Studios and what they did with Baldur's
yes.
Gate 3,
yeah.
which was so much bucking the trends. And they did end up, I'm sure it was extremely costly because it's like a 5 or 6 year development, but it ended up turning out really, really well by taking that risk.
Yeah, I've been playing Baldur's Gate 3 myself a fair amount. And I got maybe 40-ish hours into it or something. And I, you know, that is a beautifully done game. There's so much, and of course they built on their previous two titles, and the D&D 5th edition adaptation, I thought they've done a fantastic job. There's just so much to learn from, you know, the beautiful way that Larian has made Baldur's Gate 3. At the same time, I can also see areas for improvement, right? It's where I'm like, it's a little bit buggy here and there's some problems there. So even though the game gets these super good reviews, and I think that they're very well deserved, I also think it's important for people to remember, hey, it is still a consumer product that was being made by people. There are still some flaws, places where it can be improved. You know, there are still some bugs and we should, I'm not exactly sure how we should approach that as an industry other than to just acknowledge that when you get really big, very complex games, that there's a certain amount of it where you're going to have to expect both some bugs, but also expect a lot of after the fact, what's that called? A service, I guess. It seems to me games have moved more and more, especially the AAA games, into consumer products that have to be supported after they're launched, right? And it didn't used to be that way at all. It used to be you launched a game and you were done. Now it's turned into, well, the games are so big and they're so rich and there's so much going on. When you launch a game, you need to plan for like a year of support for one of these AAA games. And I see that with Larian. You know, I think Larian is doing a good job with their support.
Yeah, the other big topic going around, of course, is Starfield. We can get to that a little bit later in this because I think it touches upon some of these themes. But so you worked for Avalanche, and then I don't remember what Avalanche was doing before Disney bought you. You guys were just you worked with Pixar some stuff, and then at one point Disney bought you guys outright. Do I have
right.
that accurate?
Yeah. So the story behind why Disney bought Avalanche is Avalanche worked with THQ, and they made the TAC series of games, TAC and the Power of Juju, for the GameCube, and it actually got turned into a Nickelodeon series. So it started as a video game, and they made it into a Nickelodeon TV series. There were three TAC games, TAC and the Power of Juju, TAC the Great Juju Challenge was the third one, and TAC and the Staff of Dreams was the second. So these were games that were original properties based around kind of this, you know, little voodoo kid who had this, you know, great role. And so when Disney saw those games, they were like, oh, we want you to make games based around our kids-based properties. And so they saw the potential and the what the studio had done. So that's what they bought Avalanche, was specifically to make feature-filled kids-based games. They had that in mind for us from day one. And that's what they did, right? So Avalanche did. They're like the next 5 or 6 titles were all licensed properties, but what Avalanche surprised everybody with is that they ended up being pretty good that they were better than anybody expected those licensed properties to be, and they expanded the universes. Like we did a Chicken Little Ace in Action game, which was a completely new storyline.
I do remember that. Yes, that I did not understand why Chicken Little got a game, but it was okay. Yeah.
Well, there were two Chicken Little games, if you can believe it. There's the Chicken Little game that Avalanche did based on the film, and then they very quickly said, we want another one right away. So we did Chicken Little Ace in Action, a sequel to that game that was based in space, based around, you know, a completely new character that was the Chicken Little Ace character. And it ended up being very well received by people who played it, not very well received by just kind of the industry in general. They're like, oh, it's just another kind of shovelware game. But anybody who played it was like, this is a better game than it should be for being, you know, this Chicken Little game. And so Disney saw that. Disney saw that people who played these games liked what Avalanche was doing. And so that's why Avalanche started to get this reputation within Disney for being the studio you want to work on your property. You know, if you want a good game made based on your film, because that's what they usually want, right? Those filmmakers want games based around their properties. You want Avalanche to do it. That's how they got wrapped up with Pixar. And then they did the Toy Story 3 game. Toy Story 3 impressed Pixar so much that John Lasseter became an advocate for the Avalanche studio. And that's how Disney Infinity got made, is that, you know, Avalanche built this reputation. John Lasseter got behind them. Then they pitched this idea of Disney Infinity. And now this studio in Salt Lake is on the map, and it made $1 billion with the Disney Infinity franchise.
Yeah, the Toy Story 3 game is actually pretty good. I don't know. I haven't touched it in years, but it actually
surprises people how good it is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I don't know what they call it. It's like the toy box mode or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really, really well done.
I think the Cars 2 games, or the Cars games, are also very good. They're Mario Kart games. The people are like, oh, it's just going to be kind of a cheesy waste of a game. And then they play them and they're like, well, this is really fun. This is better in many ways than even Mario Kart. You know, they like them so much that they're surprised. And I think that's why you got that Avalanche kind of glow that flowed over into eventually making Hogwarts Legacy, that they knew how to make intellectual property and work with it because of all their experience at Disney and with all those other properties.
And important to your story, it's through Avalanche and the work you guys were doing that you got to know John Lasseter, or you got at least the chance to work with him.
Yes. Yeah. I was the game director for Cars 2. And Cars 2, the movie, John Lasseter was the director for that, or he became the director. And so I was presenting to him the game on a regular basis, and he was giving us feedback, right, on what he thought was right in the game or what was wrong in the game. And he gave us really great feedback. And that little game, that little Cars 2 game, became kind of popular inside Pixar. They started having tournaments inside the studio where the different animators and different producers and stuff would race in our Cars game, you know, to see who the best, you know, the fastest Lightning McQueen was or whatever. And that's one of my memories of working in the game industry that is really great, is playing Cars 2 on the great big Pixar screen that they normally, you know, screen their big movies like The Incredibles on or whatever. And just having a room full of Pixar animators cheering as they're playing a Cars 2 game that you worked on. That's really fun.
That is pretty cool. That is a positive. That's a golden memory you have. I would be pretty peachy if I got to work with John Lasseter at all, but to impress John Lasseter, you know, there you go.
Yeah, that was wonderful. Which, you know, then I ended up defending him later which was one of the things that came up with my YouTube channel.
Yeah, came back to bite you. So Avalanche, you know, what was going on with Disney? Because you're not the only company that this happened to. I was thinking Junction Point. I often get Avalanche and Junction Point confused.
Yeah, Junction Point was the Warren Spector studio, yeah.
Yes, and their story is very, very similar to what happened to you guys, where they were where they were the Epic Mickey. For people who don't know, Junction Point, where they did the Epic Mickey games. They were headed by Warren Spector, who's a famous game designer who created System Shock. And they were brought in. They produced one decent game. Disney wanted a sequel right away. It kind of got rushed out the door. It didn't do as well as Disney wanted, so they killed the studio. They just killed. Like, no, you're dead to me. And then they said, well, we're not even going to, we don't even want to do games ourselves anymore. We'll just have other people do it.
Yes.
You were the other side of it. You were like one of the other companies that was working in-house with Disney. I'm sure that didn't help your confidence when all that happened.
Well, it's funny because Avalanche and Junction Point actually worked together a fair amount on Epic Mickey. there was a bunch of stuff behind the scenes. I don't even know how much you're allowed to talk about that with NDA or whatever, but let's just put it this way. Avalanche helped Junction Point significantly in the making of Epic Mickey. So, you know, there was a lot of cross-pollination back and forth. I knew Warren Spector a little bit because we went to the UK and did presentations on the games that were coming out. I was working on the time at a game called Bolt, and he was working, of course, on Epic Mickey. And so there was a lot of discussion about what's going on at Disney, you know, and the video game development. And I don't want to speak too much for Warren Spector, but I know he really struggled in that position because Disney never seemed to quite at that time figure out what they wanted to do with their games division. You know, they seemed to be like, well, we want to build studios to make our own games, but that's very expensive and it takes a long time and we have to hire for it. So maybe we should just license. Maybe we should just license and have other people do it. Oh, but then that has its own problems. So maybe we should bring them in-house. And oh no, maybe we should license. And they just kept going back and forth on this sort of thing. The whole time we were working with Disney, they couldn't quite seem to figure out what their plan is to work with their intellectual property. And that's what I think happened with Disney Infinity and with Junction Point and these others, is that they would look their numbers, they would do very well on a product, but then predict for the next product in the series that it wouldn't do as well. So they'll just shut it down and license instead. And that's what happened with Infinity, I feel, is that they looked at how expensive it was going to be to keep making Infinity, said, you know what, we should just license again, just start licensing our stuff.
Were you director? I think you were director on some of the Disney Infinity play sets.
Yeah, four play sets. Yeah, there were four of them. There were three versions of Disney Infinity, and I did four play sets. It was the Lone Ranger, then Disney Infinity, the Avengers. So we worked with Marvel a lot on that one. Then it was two with Pixar. One was Inside Out, and then Finding Dory. And Finding Dory was released right about the same time as they announced they were closing down Disney Infinity and the Avalanche Studio. Very unfortunate. So almost nobody knows that there's a Finding Dory playset that was even released. But we finished it and we put it out, and it's pretty good if you can find it.
that toys to game, maybe the word fad is appropriate. It seemed like it came and went so fast. I think 2013, I remember going to a friend's house and their kids had like a collection of those spiral figures. I was like, okay, maybe this is big enough, you know, if these people I know have it. And then Disney Infinity came out and Disney Infinity was successful, and then Disney kind of pulled the plug, and then that was kind of it. And their amiibos still sort of, but not exactly the same thing. They're more collectibles per se than game figures.
Yeah, it looks to me like what happened with that Toys to Life is very similar to what happened with all the Rock Band games and stuff, you know, that it was kind of this real fad. Everybody's buying all the stuff and it's real cool. And then they kind of do it, and then it starts to feel kind of repetitive because you're doing the same thing. And then there's not a lot of places to go. And I think that's what happened with Toys to Life, is that it was, oh, it's real cool. Look at all these toys. Where are we going to go with this now that we've milked this thing for 300 toys? What are we going to do for our next 100? And I think that it just turned into that kind of, like you said, it was kind of a fad. It came through, was really hot. Disney milked it. I mean, they went after it hard. Three versions of Infinity with all those play sets in like under 4 years. Just a crazy amount of stuff that they just flooded the market. Market saturation hits. Nobody even knows what they're buying anymore because there's so much of it out there. And then the bottom kind of starts to fall out. It was just a case of, I think, hitting the market too much, too fast. And it burned it out with the Toys to Life.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it was Avalanche that got, you know, Disney cut you guys. You did guys to get cut off Disney. You're the ones that got to bear the brunt of that mistake.
Yeah, it's because they put so much effort into building up Avalanche to make Infinity, you know, because there's a part with making toys. It's a worldwide thing that the studio had grown quite big and it had a lot of stuff. So to Disney, it just looked like a huge cost center suddenly, right? Like, oh, this is a very expensive studio we built with a lot of stuff. Let's just shut them down. You know, they'll save costs just like that, which is unfortunate.
Disney way.
Yeah, the Disney way. We built it up to be great. Oh, now we got to kill it because it's too expensive. Yeah.
Oh, you could see that all. I mean, not to get, this isn't really a conversation about Disney per se, but you could see that a lot right now with how they're handling their parks or their different film franchises, or even how they're handling their cable customers that they inherited. And they're trying to like get them, they're trying to mess the services so that they can get the people, so that they'll get so desperate that they'll stop using the cable and they'll move on and they'll get the ESPN Disney Plus package. And that's just deeply nefarious to me. But that Disney is sometimes that kind of company.
I think so too. I think part of why Disney has lost its way, in my opinion, at least lately, is that it enshrined certain people who wanted to remake Disney's kind of their history of family entertainment into some new direction. Like they wanted to push a certain message on Kathleen Kennedy, who was, you know, got in charge of Star Wars. When they were first talking about what they were going to do for the next Star Wars, there's a famous picture of a whiteboard, and on the whiteboard up in the corner, it says, "Not your father's Star Wars." And that they had this objective where they were going to like remake Star Wars to be something new and fresh for modern audiences. And I really think that that infected a lot of Disney's approach, was that rather than going for what made it work in the past and what made people, why people were attracted to these properties in the first place, they got into this attitude of, we're remaking properties now in a new image and a new direction. And I think that after a while, people just started to feel like, this isn't the Disney that I loved before. Now it's trying to teach me or tell me something new. And I feel like that actually did impact some of Avalanche too, because Disney Infinity was holding on to the old view of family-oriented entertainment, right? Everything's coming in. It's all based on kind of those fun properties. And now we've got this new Star Wars that's going in a new direction. New Indiana Jones, all this, of course, the Indiana Jones wasn't going when Infinity was going on, but you could feel the change while you were at Disney, that things were changing around you for a new direction for what they wanted to do just with their properties, all the remakes and everything. And now I think they're paying the price. You know, now I think people are like, well, Disney isn't the Disney I used to now. It's something, right? All those remakes and stuff. Anyway,
that's fascinating. That's really interesting that you were there when all that was happening.
Yeah, it's just kind of strange, and you could feel it change. You could feel that. You could feel kind of in the corporate environment start to shift away from being family oriented to being more of a pushing. Like we used to have, I don't know how much I can get into this, but they made us start taking a lot more diversity, equity, and inclusion courses. Right, I remember actually complaining that in one of those meetings, I'm like, I don't think this is helping us. And they like write me in a little book. He's resisting our diversity, equity, and inclusion, retraining stuff. And this is still while we were at Disney. So I guess I already had a black mark for being a bit of a pushback against those sorts of things, even at Disney. So,
yeah, those early days, people hardly even knew what that stuff was. Now people are pretty familiar to watch out for. And I think the big mistake with Disney, too, is they had this attitude that they could do anything and people would just show up anyways. There's a great Bob Iger quote about when they wanted to release Galaxy's Edge. And the quote is, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically, you know, whatever we make, they will come. You know, they'll just be so ravenous to come to our Disney Star Wars park thing. You know, so when they did this disastrous, I don't even know what they were thinking, but the Star Wars hotel that's a
right
cruise.
Yeah, that galactic, yeah, star cruiser thing. Yeah,
yes, and it fell on its face like really big, and it's like, to anyone outside the Disney ecosystem, you're like, what were you thinking? Like, what did you think was going to happen?
Yeah, I saw some pictures from that. It's like they put you in a cement box and say, hey, you're on a Star Cruiser, ain't it great? $2,000 a night or something.
Yeah, that's,
and
people, right, are like, we'll have our 2K now, thank you.
Yeah,
I hope you enjoyed your grapes.
I think you hit on something, that it felt like Disney started to feel like, oh, they had a built-in fan base. We got fans no matter what. We can do whatever we want, right? And that's not true. You know, people, if you're not treating your fans with respect, don't expect them to treat you with respect, you know? And I think that's what happened with Disney is they started treating their fans like, oh, it's a done deal. They'll be there no matter what we do. At least it felt like that to me, even in, you know, at the end of Disney and their later films. But no, fans are not going to be there if you're not respected. Which is, you know, now we come to Hogwarts Legacy, I guess, and we definitely respected the
fans.
That's a good transition.
That's a good transition. Because Hogwarts Legacy was a whole different approach. It was, we want to take care of our consumers. We want them to feel that they're wanted here. We want to make a product that they will want and enjoy and share, which is a whole different way to look at things, the way it probably should be.
Yes, I believe very sincerely that from day one, Avalanche's charter on making Hogwarts Legacy for Warner Brothers was make a game that the fans will want to play, right? That from day one, make it true to the lore, make it as much as possible, all those things that you ever wanted to do. We used to talk about fan fantasies when we were early developing Hogwarts Legacy. What do you want to do if you could ever go to Hogwarts? And we would try and figure out how we could incorporate as much of that as possible in the early design phase. So it was very much driven by what do the fans want. And we knew early on, authenticity was crucial, right? It has to feel right. The lore has to be there. And so that's why most of the folks who were working in the writing or in the building of like the castle just became experts on everything Harry Potter and Hogwarts so that they could really know what it was they were doing. And that passion, I think you can feel all the way through the product, all the way through the game. Even though Hogwarts Legacy is not a perfect game, there's a lot of problems with it, right? A lot of areas that could have been better. The passion of treating the intellectual property with respect gives it like that extra point or two in review scores. I think that people just get in and go, wow, somebody gets it. They know the magic of the Harry Potter universe. So even though this isn't, isn't Harry Potter or Hermione, it feels like it's the right time, the right place, and it has that sense. At least I think they succeeded in doing that.
I agree. This is how I kind of judge my RPGs. I love an RPG, both Japanese and Western. If after the playing the game, I want to go read a Wikipedia article or watch someone talk about a lore in like a lore video, and they have a dramatic voice, not always. That to me is like, okay, this game is really engaging with me. That's kind of my test for like, okay, is this true to the material? And I did get that out of Hogwarts Legacy. It's like, okay, maybe I need to go look at some of this stuff from J.K. Rowling again, because I thought maybe it was kind of shallow, but how that game was handled, it really excellent. It really is engrossing and it brings you into it. I think as a game, it's a perfect Harry Potter simulator. Now, as a game, a little less so, but as something that makes you feel like I'm being transported into the world of Harry Potter, I'd been totally nailed that.
Yeah, and then warms my fuzzy little heart to hear that, because I think that was the objective. We wanted people from the beginning to, when they play Hogwarts Legacy, we want them to feel like this is your game. This is you as a wizard now at Hogwarts in this time frame as best you can. And I think most people kind of get a bit of that sense that it feels right. It'll be interesting to see where it goes, the franchise in the future, but.
Yeah, I think I read recently that they're planning to work on a sequel, so we'll have to see. One of the interesting things, maybe you know more about this. Some people, they were looking through the game files, discovered there were kind of elements that were missing. And if you play the game, there are things that kind of like point to maybe there was like a character romance system, or there was an influence system, something like that. They're just little ticks for like, well, I played a lot of RPGs. That's typically where this kind of thing goes. Do you know really what was going on in development there? Were those just features that didn't really work, and so you guys dropped them and moved on, or do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, so while I worked on Hogwarts Legacy, I worked over two areas of the game. One was the NPC behaviors, so all the stuff with companions and NPCs running around the school and all that. So that was one part. The other part was the Hogwarts Legacy castle construction itself. So I was producer over those two things. I started out as a designer. So all that stuff that you're asking about, that's NPC behavior stuff, right? Romance, companions, different things that you're supposed to do. And the answer is yes, that we did have lots of explorations into lots of ideas about what we could do there. But it wasn't so much that things were cut as things didn't develop to a point where we thought that they would be commercially ready or able to be released. At least, when I was at the studio, we were working on some really clever and creative like ways to try and, simulate some things and then explore some ideas. But the more we put the game in front of players, and the more that we experienced the game ourselves, it became increasingly clear that a strict simulation probably wasn't what most players were expecting. They wanted something that had more characters, more richness, more like Mass Effect, more like maybe a little more in that realm of the Red Dead Redemption or Cyberpunk or The Witcher, that all those sorts of games, rather than something that was too simulated, right? And so we found the game drifted or moved that way, mostly from the interacting with players. Players would interact with it, they'd play it, and they wanted more of what I would call mass market sort of experience. They wanted to get into things faster. They wanted to interact with characters more. They wanted that sort of the game more than they wanted like a school simulation that was very like restrictive, or that, not restrictive is the wrong word, but very like tight on your time, or you had to go to class at certain periods or that sort of thing. So those were ideas that were explored, but not into the final game because we followed what the players seem to want. So, or you know,
that makes sense. That makes sense because that game attracted a lot of people who may not play a lot of video games. It's my niece and nephew who are 5 and 3 respectively. It's their favorite game, and they've now had it, I don't know how many months, 7 months. And it's really the only game they actually like to play, and they do not get very far. But if they can get past even one room, one puzzle, they are so very proud. I love to see them do that. To see the smiles on their faces over it. Just like, oh, it's great. It is great. I get what you're saying. It's less kind of like the early Elder Scrolls were more open-ended, and it's more, like you said, Mass Effect, where it's more scripted. I think for people, that's even when you were doing Starfield here, it does seem like even Bethesda themselves have kind of acknowledged that's where people are at right now, what they want. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah, so that was a big part of that. I also mentioned, I think it was on, it was a podcast with Neon that, we did have a key developer on the NPC Behaviors team who was also killed in a tragic accident, and that impacted the team too. So there's, you can see in the credits for Hogwarts Legacy, it says in loving memory of Dave Ross, who was a longtime Avalanche employee, an older gentleman, right at the end, even older than me. He was ready to retire, was killed, and it just wrecked our whole team, right? So you got months of people trying to recover from a key guy who's no longer there, and you had to remake the team. But
that's really destructive because gaming, the knowledge that one person may have, the others may not. You know, people would like to think you could just slot different people in, but that's not how it is.
Yeah, and especially you can't do that when you've got experts who have been around for years and years and years and years, right? And that's what happened in our case, is we had a very senior guy who was involved in our NPC behavior stuff, and then suddenly you've got this hole on the team and nobody can fill it, and so you have to remake the team. You just have to and that's when I switched from being a designer to the producer. Actually, it was that started a whole cascade. It was the death of this one guy, this one developer, then caused us to have to rethink how we had organized a team, which then caused a shift in a bunch of positions, which then made me go from being a designer back to being a producer again, so that I could help the team cover those holes.
It's after that you become a producer that, everything starts to shake off.
Right. Yeah. So I was producer for the next 2 years after that. Yeah. So
that's so crazy to me, because it's like because I can't even imagine your experience, Troy, because it's like, you're just working on this game. You got your own home life. You're very focused. You're a normal person with a normal life. And then just out of nowhere, it's like a bomb goes off. And you're like being talked about everywhere. And you're the villain of the week on every gaming news site. And Reset Era, has become cultish in their behavior, tracking your movements. And it's like, I'm sure for you, that would have been a crazy whiplash. Because you're like, where is all this coming from? I was just my own business.
It was really, well, there were two things that were going on there that made it especially bad. So I said on my YouTube channel, I gave a little bit of background about why, because I quit, right? I left the studio under pressure, but I didn't leave exclusively because of all the attacks on me. I already had a family issue that had me leave the studio for 2 months and move states. So I had left from Utah, moved down to Nevada, got married, was living in a new house, and had left the project for 2 months to do this move. In fact, I was going to quit right then, but Avalanche asked me to stay. And so I was working remotely from Nevada. Then this family stuff got really hot, and then the press articles hit. So I had two things happening right at the same time. So I had a family member staying with me at my place here in Nevada at the same time all these press articles hit. And it was just so much pressure on me all at once that I did that. You know what? I got to focus on my family issues first, put the family before the work, because I don't see how I can do both of these right now. And so I told John Blackburn, the head of the studio, I'm just going to re-retire. I was going to retire back in October. You guys asked me to stay on to, you know, help finish out the game, and the family thing went crazy. I'm just going to go back to retirement. And he was like, yeah, I understand. You know, this is crazy. I can't believe all the fire and the attack there. So he accepted my resignation without too much, you know, pressure. And for me, it made me feel a lot better right away, because then I dropped the whole Hogwarts Legacy thing. I quit getting attacked within a couple of days, you know, of saying that I was leaving. And then I just focused on the family for the next like 4 to 6 months. And then things got better on the family front. And it turns out that that was probably the right choice. Right. So
I was reading a gamer article, and it literally feels like when you're reading it that they moved targets. Like, you can feel the reticle move from Troy back to J.K. Rowling, which I just find that, I thought that was kind of fascinating. I hate how you got treated. I think it was downright ridiculous. And, you know, forgive me, I think myself and many people believed, you know, that you were, how do I put this politely, that you were caving under pressure and you were trying to make the best decision for your, you know, for your company, probably for your family, because, you know, we didn't know about if family issues are true or not. But, you know, you were just trying to make the best decision for the people around you and yourself. And you took the decision that most people would. Though I do believe it when you say it actually was family, you know, and all these things kind of just happen at the same time. I am disabled. I know how that works. So it does happen. But that wasn't how it felt like to us on the other end who didn't know all that much about what was going on.
Right. And that's fair. I completely understood at the time that it looked like, hey, they just forced him out. And the thing is I was not able to do my job very well because the attacks were so persistent that I was having calls like, so my day after this happened was almost all taken up by, first I have a call with HR, then I have a call with John Blackburn, then I go to a regular call when I'm supposed to be working on Hogwarts Legacy, right? And then I'd come back and I'd do a call with PR, and then I'd have another call with HR, and then I'd have another call with Blackburn. Oh, and then I go do a call on the Hogwarts Castle. And so basically I was spending like, it felt like 2/3 of my day trying to do damage control over, because they were giving me information, right? They were like, they had a PR team that was like out there saying, okay, Troy, we advise you not to say anything on Twitter. We advise you not to, you know, do anything and keep very quiet. We advise you not to talk to other people at the studio about this, which was very strange. But I understood why, because they didn't want like the studio getting all wrapped up in this whole mess.
Well, and Troy, you do realize that the only reason Liam Robertson, who originally reported it, someone had to tell him that information was not something he discovered. Someone gave him that information.
Is that right? See, that's what Neon says too. Is that like he was just a shill to push it into the mainstream.
It's because, and I've worked with these people. They don't have that traditional investigative skills. Generally, he actually does some decently like game dev history work. That actually is pretty good. Putting aside the other stuff he does, but he is not someone that's going to be like looking for random YouTube channels. You know, YouTube is so big, it's so hard to find specific people. That's when it's so obscure. No, they had to have, someone had to tell them, you know, from my point of view, it's like, well, if someone in your company wants to cause problems, better not to just keep everything quiet, let shake out. But that's just me. That's just based on my experience. That's nothing I can prove necessarily.
Yeah. It was pretty weird that, yeah, just the way I, that's one of those things that's still hard for me to wrap my head around, that it was like a targeted thing, because it always feels to me, or at least the way that I interpreted it, was they really want to get JK rolling. They really want to get JK rolling. How could we get her? And they just started looking for something, and they said, hey, this is the best we can come up with. There's this guy working on Hogwarts Legacy, yep, who made these videos. And they're really not that bad, but we could pretend like they are. We can act like they're really crazy, and then we can attack JK. And to me, it felt like I was collateral damage, right? That they didn't really care about my stupid channel, this little channel off the side. They wanted to get at her, and I was just kind of, you know, a convenient angle on it. But Neon made me rethink that. Neon said, no, they maybe have had it out for you because you called out some of the elites in the industry in some of your videos, and they may have had like a grudge, and that they were angry and just kind of bitter, and, you know, that it was more targeted personally than it may have even seemed to you. Yeah.
Then Ian's pretty smart. Ian of Clownfish TV. He's a smart cookie. He has a good feeling for a lot of this stuff because he's been around. I don't know what I was gonna say. The wheel. around the block. The block, a different shape.
Yeah.
He's been around the block. What I want to talk about some of the specific things that they went after, because I felt what was so interesting about this, and I think it does stand up. It says, it felt like, first of all, the attacks on you were very much like, okay, this is Gamergate 2.0. Look, it's one of these awful people. So then they just throw, you know, all the things they have in the grab bag for bad persons. Like, there you go. You're anti-Semite. Boom. You're alt-right. Boom, you're a turd. You know, they just take it, they throw it, see if it sticks. The other thing I noticed, and I'm just going to read. This is kind of like the big one. Liam Robertson, who's a freelance journalist, like I said, he works with Did You Know Gaming. He's the first one that talks about this in some tweets. And there's a video, I think. And then this is the big article that kind of like that broke it, I think, for most people. And I read these two paragraphs, and I'm just going to read them here with you. This information first provided by Did You Know Gaming contributor Liam Robertson, who highlighted the channel Friday evening on Twitter. The company's screenshot shows a small portion of his YouTube channel there. The injustice of social justice, in praise of cultural appropriation, are thought crimes becoming real? The latter a reference to George Orwell's dystopic sci-fi novel 1984. Right-wing commentators often use the book's authoritarian Big Brother government as a comparison point in their criticism, likening the fictional surveillance state to real-world equality movements. Among Levitt's other videos are lengthy defenses of both John Lasseter, the Pixar co-founder who left his position at Disney 2017 after allegations of sexual misconduct, and Nolan Bushnell. By the way, I did not know this was like a bad thing you could do if you thought well of Nolan Bushnell. The Atari co-founder, who Kotaku's reporting found it fostered a toxic work environment from women.
Which is complete garbage. Oh, that still makes me mad to this day.
I agree. In some of his videos, Levitt expressed support for Gamergate, a movement that fostered harassment against women and other minorities of the gaming industry, and criticized Anita Sarkeesian's Tropes Us. I have never heard of that. Women's series is an I've heard of her. I don't know what that is. Uninformed
Tropes versus
fringe
women.
Position. Yeah. Levitt discussed his opinions on Gamergate in a depth interview, saying Gamergate, while painful at times, on the whole, proved to be a good thing. What I get from this article, and not just this article, but some of the other ones I read for this interview, including The Gamer, it's like, number one, what they hate you for is that you are one of these bad people. Number two, they hate that they feel they cannot control you, that you don't belong to the pack, that you have the wrong politics. Not that you necessarily have done anything wrong, but just that you weren't all in on their feelings about what gaming should be. You know, you have to be pro social justice. You have to be pro that. You can't be anti this. And you were just being somewhat critical of some of that stuff. And that seemed to bother them more than the actual stuff where they were saying you were dangerous. You know, it's like if this just was like a real situation, like a Harvey Weinstein, they were like, actually, you know, we always sort of care about what Harvey Weinstein did in his hotel room, but we really hate who he voted for in 2016. And that was kind of like what I get from all these. It's like, you guys need to understand, he's not just in Gamergate. He's not on our team. He's not on the good guy team. So you have to do something about him. And that was pretty much as far as it extended intellectually, as far as I could tell.
It felt very similarly to me, too, that it was more like, this guy doesn't have the correct political opinions, therefore he's a threat to all that is good and just and right in the universe. And they even had to like massage what they thought my political opinions might be to make me look worse, you know, than actually just saying, well, this is what he actually says and this is what he actually believes. They never do that. They just like, he is an anti-feminist, he's gonna post this, you know. And like I said on Colin Moriarty's channel, you know, every single time that I criticized an Anita Sarkeesian or spoke out against an aspect of, you know, feminist critique, every time I would give, instead of this feminist, consider this feminist. And I would give a different feminist who had a different take on it that was, you know, I thought more amenable to, you know, just the world we live in. So I would, you know, Camille Paglia or Christina Hoff Sommers. And that just infuriated me that they saw me as anti-feminist because I didn't like the right feminists that they approved in their little gaming community circle. And I'm like, that's crazy, isn't it? That you can go and say, we only approve like four feminists. And if you're not one of those four, you're an anti-feminist, you know? This is what I've learned
too, because I my training is actually a disability health reporter, but I like to moonlight kind of doing some entertainment stuff, entertainment writing, game writing. My experiences with that click and trying to get into games journalism more professionally is it very much is you have to be on the specific team. You have to be in the right click. You have to be on the right team. And if you aren't, if you dare try to apply for a job at Kotaku or Forbes Gaming or Polygon, gosh forbid, you better, we're gonna have to pray for your soul. I'm not joking though. Last year, I had a good friend that pretty successful journalist blogger, and they had an empty slot. This decently up there prestigious website that wanted more people to talk about gaming, specifically esports. So they got me in. They had the recruiter. We did a back and forth for over like 3 months. It was going great at the end of the part. And the guy, the recruiter, was like, okay, this is pretty much a done deal. We're going to send this past HR and they're probably going to approve it. You're good. I was like, awesome. Great. I wasn't sure this ever could have come together, but all right, let's do this. And then next time I get an email, it's like, they shut me down real quick. And it's almost like the tone is like, oh, we've made a grievous error talking to you. And my friend pointed out that from what he could tell was someone else had learned about the application and was uncomfortable with it and had stayed opposition, and that was enough to derail everything. And that's kind of just my own personal experience. But having talked to other people who've actually worked in games journalism officially, like we're one of the special people, at least briefly. My friend Vito is one of these. Tim Ferriss is another. There really is this kind of click mentality. It's not just politics, although it is politics. It's not just you're saying you're doing the wrong thing. Maybe you're pro Gamergate or you agree with one of their arguments. It's really you don't belong to the club, and that is enough for them to just push you out, attack you, throw you under the bus, whatever. They do not care. And I think that's what happens over and over again. And every now and then, it's really like apparent and naked. And that's what happened to you, Troy, because it was like, oh, now everyone can see it. Because I think that's what made your story a little different. It wasn't just that this was happening. Other people have been destroyed by the gaming press. It was that everyone could see it, and they understood that this wasn't quite a legitimate attack. Like, something was wrong here. And I do think, the other things were happening to places like Kotaku that put gaming press in a really bad position. But I think this did help push it that direction, because I know for myself, it was like, well, do we trust these outlets at all? Like, are they even reliable when they give us newsworthy information? And I think that really shredded their reputation. So as much as I hate what happened to you, I think maybe in some ways it was really useful, because it was like a good way to get a thermometer. Like, where is the gaming press? Like, who are they? What are they doing? And it turns out, not very good.
Yeah, I think in a funny way, by me quitting and leaving, it kind of took the wind out of the sails for the gaming press, because then they didn't have anybody else to attack on the team, right? And so, yeah, in a way, I almost see like it was a good thing, and Hogwarts Legacy ended up coming out and being very successful anyway, right? It like all this sound and fury signified nothing in the end, right? They made all this noise and tried to boycott and tried to make the game look bad, and it still went off to make, it's the best-selling game of the year. I saw a thing today, right? There's an article out today that 6 months after Hogwarts Legacy has been launched, it is again hitting the top of the charts in the UK. So it's made $1 billion. And this is in spite of a coordinated effort by the gaming press to shut it down, right? They were trying to tell people what they could like and what they couldn't like, what is right for them to play and what is not right for them to play. And gamers would have none of it. And I am so proud of gamers for doing that, for saying, no, we're just going to play what we want to play. That's the right response.
The gaming press really does believe they own the industry. Like, the games industry is huge. It's billions of dollars. And they're like really small fish. They're even the world of journalism. They're small. But they really do have this attitude that they own the industry and they should be able to dictate terms. Even when my friends I'm friendly with, maybe I call him a friend. I don't have to ask him. Gene Park, who's now the only game journalist left at the Washington Post, or Eric Kane over at Forbes.
Yeah, I like Eric Kane a lot. Yeah.
I remember, this is just around the same time what happened to you, and maybe the people in games journalism were feeling perky. They're like, oh, we can't, let's go for another round. And they attacked both him and Eric because they dared talk to Colin Moriarty. And people were like, he worked for IGN. He was like one of IGN's top guys as recently as 2014. But that was enough. I mean, it's so, and maybe I'm talking this because I feel like a jilted girlfriend. Maybe I'm a little burnt out. But it really does feel like there's this negative, controlling relationship. This is like an abusive spouse. And it you feel like you have to just cut it out. But it's too bad because actually the gaming press is an important role to get information out. You know, stories like yours should have been, you know, someone should have done like a long form article like, oh, we went out, we met Troy, we talked with him, we met his family, we interviewed people at Avalanche WB. Here's what happened. Of course, that didn't happen. But in a healthy, sane world, that you would hope it would. Right. That was a mouthful, but yeah, semi-piece.
No, but I agree with everything you've said there. And I also have, you know, tremendous affection and respect for Colin Moriarty because, you know, he did go out and he's put together that Last Stand Media, which continues to do well and is a great source of insight and information into the games industry. So I, you know, kudos to him for, because he got canceled too, right? He got canceled for making a tweet. And then he said, screw this, I'm going to go start my own company. And he did. And he's done very well. So good job on Colin.
Yeah, the it's so crazy what's happening with the gaming press, with the entertainment news in general. It's just kind of falling apart right now, mostly because Google, Meta, so Facebook, and Twitter have kind of cut off the traffic. They have just decided, you know what, we don't really need people to go to links. I mean, we don't really need people to go to these other websites. We'll just regurgitate the information and summarize it ourselves. And so it's like really, really difficult to get any ad revenue whatsoever right now because the traffic is just completely puttered out. But some of it is the ethics. Some of it is people are just done and they're not willing to give you the time of day. It's no surprise when Hogwarts Legacy launches. This fits right in. Who are the people that they focus on bringing in to promote the game? Do they bring in do you have people from Kotaku hosting Hogwarts Legacy? We gave early copies to Kotaku.
Right.
And they're going to be our ambassadors for Hogwarts Legacy. No, that's not what happened.
That's not what happened, right?
What happened, Troy?
They went straight to the fans. Chandler Wood, they hired a community manager, and he started pushing to go directly to the fan channels on YouTube. And that was a brilliant move because these fan channels, the Expecto Go, Retro Raconteur, Podcast Now, Benjamin's, there's a whole bunch of them that they just started talking about the game and how excited they were. And Avalanche and Chandler started feeding them little tidbits. And the next thing you know, you've got this snowball effect of people really excited about the game and they're checking everything that comes out. And the press has had nothing to do with it, right? There's no gaming press that's involved. It's just YouTubers who are taking apart the little bits and pieces that Avalanche is giving them. And they built this whole hype train around Hogwarts Legacy all on their own. And it's marvelous to see. I think it was a brilliant move. And then when the game came out, WB snubs several of the former press outlets that had, you know, spoken ill of the game or of me. Like, I don't think they sent one to Kotaku and several others saying, no press copy for you. You know, we already know you're hostile to the game.
You're going to have to review it on the same day as everyone else.
Everyone else. And then which company or which organization rated the game a 1 out of 10 based on J.K. Rowling's, you know,
Was that Wired? Wired gave a ridiculous
I think it was Wired.
Yeah, and they hired this lady who I don't think had ever written about games before or since, but they put her in charge of it.
Yeah, it's so obviously politically motivated, right? It's like, why would anybody ever trust these guys to tell you anything about any other games or anything else when they obviously are politically motivated to attack this one game?
1 out of 10 is like the game doesn't play at all. It works better as a coaster. That's like a 1 out of 10. You have to try really hard to get the 1 out of 10.
And Hogwarts Legacy did it. Woo!
It is so crazy. It is positive. I mean, it makes me happy because there was so much attacks on it, and then everyone pushed back, and then the game got, I don't know if it helped support the sales, that was kind of the impression it gave, and it got really big, and everyone was loving it. It was just kind of a nice little happy ending. I felt good for you, even though you weren't there really to enjoy. I was like, well, this had a nice resolution in the end.
Well, I feel like it had a happy ending. I still see pretty much daily on Twitter or elsewhere people talking about how much they enjoy Hogwarts Legacy and how it enriched their lives, and you know, they had a lot of fun with their family and friends, just like you were saying, the kids who were playing. And that
my niece and nephew, Lee and Ezra. Yeah.
That is so awesome. That's why I think if you're a developer, you make games in the first place, right? Is you want players to have a wonderful experience. And when you see that they are having that experience, then you're like, oh, good. We did something nice in the world. There are millions of people, millions of more smiles that have been added out into the world. We brightened the world a little bit. That's a positive thing. That's a good thing. And that's why you really do it. The money and the success is all nice, but it's those good feelings, those emotions, those families, that brightening of the world is what I think video games can really do, and what I think Hogwarts Legacy did so well for so many players.
Excellent. You re-retire. Do you have any interest in working in games again? What are you doing with yourself these days? What do you hope to do?
It's kind of funny because I had all these like, oh, I'm going to run right off and just start doing my thing. So I started working on my book again, like my third book. And then I realized I was going to write both of them at once rather than two. And then I started writing. I taught myself how to program in Game Maker. So I made this little game where you like had skeletons coming down with parachutes and you shoot them, you know, just a little 2D independent game. And then I started playing chess. So basically what I'm doing in retirement is I'm screwing around doing a bunch of different things. I've had a few people contact me saying, hey, Troy, do you want to help work on this game, or do you want to join us in this new idea? And so far I've turned them all down gently. You know, I've said, oh, you got a good idea there. I think that's interesting, but I'm liking being kind of retired and out of games right now and just, you know, pursuing my own kind of interests, even though I'm not being very productive. You know, I'm kind of just, I've only been retired a couple of years. I'm playing around. I'm having fun. I don't want to give up having fun.
That's fair. When you were working game development, did you have to deal with a lot of crunch? Was that something you experienced too?
Yeah. Yes. And I actually think that crunch is one of those things that may be hard, if not impossible, to completely get rid of in the industry just because of those issues I mentioned earlier, that you never know what you're dealing with. It's such an unknown that it's very, very hard to plan delivery dates and time frames. That's what really drives crunch, right? The reason that you end up with crunch is that you make plans about when you're trying to deliver something, and you underestimate the amount of work or time involved to get there. And so you end up having to push all that work and time in to still hit your deliverable deadlines. And I don't see that there's an easy way to get out of this because it's a creative industry. In other words, there's no build to spec proposition. There's no way to say it will take exactly 17 days for us to do this. Instead, you'll say, oh, I think we'll have that ready in 2 weeks. And it turns out that it's 3 weeks.
Done. Yeah, it's done when it's done.
And, right. There's no way for a game to just cook forever until it's completely done, because a game is never finished. There's always something that you want to add, fix, improve, make better, faster, more performance. So you basically at some point just have to start putting in gates to say, all right, we're going to have to ship this thing, or we're going to, you know, run out of money. So you have to start backing those dates out. And that's where crunch time starts to work back in, is because you're like, well, if we're going to ship then we're going to have to submit to first party here, which means we have to have this much QA time, which means, oh my gosh, we have to be done by last Tuesday, you know, because the time frames just back out when you start figuring out how much work still needs to be done. And it's not just, a lot of people think, oh, it's just a matter of planning. It's really not. It's more a matter of the nature of game development, that whenever you experience it, you discover new things that you need to do to make the game better. You don't have like a clearly defined target until you start putting milestones down where you have to deliver. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I'm kind of explaining why it's so hard to get rid of.
I understand. Yeah. Well, for people who haven't actually worked in games, including myself, it's like, we do need the context. I think, what was I going to say? It'll come back to me. Oh, yeah. I'm trying to think of the name, but there was recently a famous game developer, and he made the comment, he got a little bit of hot water for making it, We made the comment that what happened with game development and crunch is that in the early days, crunch was happening there mostly because the people who were developing the game wanted to be there. And, you know, they said that maybe it was a bit younger, they were more male, and they were just like, they wanted to do that kind of insane amount of hours to sharpen the project, make it as great as it could. But as games changed, you know, it becomes more money, more corporatized, and of course, the games now not just being released day, but forever, that changed too. So crunch is no longer this, you know, quick race to the finish line. It's like this never-ending marathon, potentially.
Yeah, and you're right. I think whichever developer said that is correct, that, you know, for about 20 years, from like 95 to maybe 2015, right around that time frame, I think most of the people who were working in games were there because they wanted to be there. They were excited. And so crunch for many of them was like, oh, it's just expected because we're trying to make a great product and we're running out of time. And if we're going to make this, you know, great animation or great art or great music, we're going to have to put in the extra time on the weekend. That's just how it was, because you thought you were making something amazing. But I think starting around 2015-ish or whatever, it did feel to me like the industry started to shift into a more mature policing stage where now people are like, oh, that doesn't fly anymore. If you're coming here, it's a 9-to-5 job. And so we need to start, you know, taking some of the edges out of the game and make it more like a assembly line process, you know, more like where we can make it predictive, where we can lay everything out. And that's fine. That makes a lot of sense, but it also gets rid of opportunities for creativity and that creative chaos. And you end up with people making games, I think in general, that start to feel more and more cookie cutter in the AAA industry, where they start looking at pieces from other games. How are they going to save time? We'll just do the same thing they did in that game. We'll just do the same thing they did in that game. And you end up with this loss of quality. At the same time, the industry itself is becoming more and more like a corporate police state where everybody's only allowed to work certain hours and, you know, that sort of thing. Otherwise they get in trouble. It hasn't reached that point yet, but you can feel it changing, right? The industry has made a change where the AAA games, just a lot of the people who are working on them aren't working on them because they love their jobs. They're not working on them because they have a job. And that's kind of unfortunate, you know. I think Hogwarts Legacy is a bit of an exception to that, but I know that there were some people even working on Hogwarts Legacy who were like, man, this is a big game and I just want to get it done, you know.
And
they weren't doing it because they loved it anymore. They were doing it because it was a job that had to be done. And that's, you know, that's just how it is, I think, in any creative industry, movies and stuff too. So,
yeah, I have a brother who just graduated med school. And so he's doing is it residency? I'm so tired. My words are completely fried. So I'm sure I'm going to use the wrong word, but let's call it an internship. You know, that's expected of recent grads trying to get started as a doctor. It's like there was a big controversy within the last 10 years where Congress passed a law and said you couldn't work these people more than 40 hours at a time. But yeah. It's like, anyone is like, wait, what? Like, what's the bare minimum here? But that was how it is. And he says, you know, this is just kind of part of the culture. It's part of how we do this. It's like, you want to be there. So like, you know, you're, it's a little bit like hazing. You want to be there. So you're going to go through with it. And you know, there are positive negatives to that. And, you know, with game design, art, you know, that's very cultural specific. And like, yeah, maybe, like you said, maybe you get more of the 9-to-5 people and they're happy, but maybe the game is less interesting because this is more like, okay, you know, what's on the company card this week? And
yeah,
it's too bad.
I'm sure we're still going to have a lot of, you know, great AAA games in the future, and it's going to continue to make its mark on the industry. But my opinion is that I think most of the new, fascinating, interesting stuff is probably going to come from independent developers who are just putting in all their hours and doing crazy stuff. And, you know, they're doing it because they want to do something amazing and interesting. Well, as I think our AAA games are probably going to be a lot more like Hollywood blockbusters. They'll start to feel a little bit similar, even though they might be really polished and have all sorts of cool explosions. And, you know, I think we'll have beautiful, beautiful games with amazing AI and richness and all this coolness, but they might not be that creative or interesting in the same way that I think independent games are. At least in the near future, until AI starts making them all. So
Yeah, no, there's a few companies. It definitely feels like that right now, like Blizzard, Ubisoft, like the really big boys. Like their games are very cookie cutter these days.
They're cookie cutter because it makes them predictable, right? It helps with the executive way. It helps them when they can say they can lay out pieces. So a lot of times it's not because the developers are bad or they can't do the job. It's because they're being told to meet certain objectives to fit within, you know, that larger picture. I just think that's important so that people don't think the AAA designers and developers don't love what they're doing, because I think most of them do. I just think they're in a very difficult position now where they're being told to, like, we need, you know, to fit these criteria on these time frames, and that takes away a lot of their opportunities to explore, right?
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. Wrapping up here, talking about games, I think it's almost darkly comical is what's happened to, like, BioWare, that studio, because BG3, Baldur's Gate 3, which we already talked a little bit about, is kind of like the game BioWare should have made like 12 years ago. And EA is just gutting that studio now. But part of me, you can't wholly blame them, because it's like, well, they're coming out with a new Dragon Age, but it looks so far it's not going to be very Dragon Age-esque. It's more going to be like an action brawler. Thank you, if that was the word. It's like, it's hard to watch, but BioWare is one of those studios where, like, you have much reporting where, like, they're just spending years experimenting and going back and forth and never really deciding anything. That's kind of how you get Anthem. It's fascinating to me, like, they have EA, they have all this money and support, and then the game that they should have made, another smaller company goes out and makes it. I think the games industry is so fascinating in that way, in a way that maybe a lot of other industries are not. But it seems like a stressful one. Seems like a stressful industry to be involved with.
Yeah, and it's kind of strangely small, too, in that you end up knowing a lot of other developers. You just mentioned Anthem. Here's a strange thing about Anthem. The game director for Anthem, guy named Jonathan Warner. Jonathan Warner used to work at Avalanche and worked on Cars 2. So the director of Avalanche worked on Cars 2, or the director of Anthem worked at Avalanche on Cars 2. So in that's crazy, right? Like, you get these people who move around from different studios.
Oh, that poor game. I'm not sure it was safe. I'm not sure they could save it.
Yeah, I really like John Warner. I feel bad about that Anthem didn't do better. It feels to me like they needed some more support in some key ways. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, hey, thank you so much, Dave, for coming on the show, Troy. I love this stuff. I have always been interested in the game industry, but I have none of the right skills or talents to actually work in it. So being an observer and learning, hearing your stories, sharing your experiences, this has been wonderful. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you? Do you do a lot of social media these days? You said you might work on a book. Where can people find your stuff?
Well, my YouTube channel is still live. You can always go there if you want to see. And I have posted a few videos since I left Avalanche, mostly about, like, I did one on artificial intelligence and then another one on Hogwarts Legacy. But I'm really quiet right now on social media, so I'm not, like, doing a lot. I might make some more videos at some point. People kind of ask that, but I'm not trying to make money. You know, I'm not, like, trying to promote myself necessarily. I'm just out here talking to people and having fun. And so come visit if you want. Come visit my channel if you want. Follow me on Twitter if you want. But don't expect me to be like some firebrand who's doing a lot of crazy stuff. I'm just having fun.
Definitely. You're not. It feels like everyone on Twitter right now, everyone and their mother is trying to get the sweet Twitter ads cash. So everyone is just grifting or stealing other people's content or trying to, like, inflame things. And it's like, it feels like they're, like, dedicating many hours to make this happen, and they get a paycheck. It's like $40. Like how many hours did you put in to get that? Oh, well.
It's like YouTube feels like that to me sometimes. Oh, I put all this time into making a video.
Definitely. Yeah. It's your hard work. Here's $1.50. Congratulations. All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up here, guys. Thank you so much for watching Culturescape. This show is made possible by the wonderful folks at Bain Books Publishing, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Thank you to them. Thank you to Young Voices. And thank you to my editor, Chris Hollywicki, whose editing makes me look so much more competent than I actually am. And of course, all of you who are watching and listening to the show. This wouldn't be possible without your support. Well, we're going to cut it here. And until next time, my friends, keep geeking out. Well, Troy, I've